Hello, it's Monday, June the 1st. I'm Belinda Rhodes. In the programme today, high-tech warfare in northern Pakistan as the US sends microchips into Taliban hideouts.
These microchips or electronic devices transmit some sort of signal that then allows the CIA and the US military to identify the homes of Taliban and particularly Al-Qaeda militants.
With polls predicting meltdown for Labour on Thursday in the wake of the expenses scandal, we ask what the week holds for Gordon Brown. And as General Motors stares bankruptcy in the face, we find out what that means for the company and its workers.
Other brands are up for sale, including Hummer, Saab, Opel and Vauxhall in Europe are being sold off.
All that to come, but first a roundup of the news and a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, claimed expenses for two homes at the same time, according to the Daily Telegraph. A spokesman for the Chancellor says the allegation of double claiming is simply untrue. However, the latest headlines will add to the pressure on the Prime Minister to remove Mr Darling from number 11. Yesterday, Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg singled out the Chancellor's claims and called for him to be sacked. The hunt for a British businessman suspected of beating his girlfriend to death is continuing today. Cheshire Police urged 39-year-old Ian Griffin to make contact with the authorities after his girlfriend was found dead in a Paris hotel. Griffin's been on the run since Tuesday. A doctor specialising in late-term abortions has been shot dead in the American city of Wichita in Kansas. Dr. George Tiller, who is 67, had been regularly targeted by abortion opponents who protested outside his clinic. The shooting comes just 2 weeks after Barack Obama sought common ground over the abortion debate in a speech at one of America's leading Catholic universities. Much of the UK is set to enjoy another day of sunshine as the hot spell continues. The seaside town of Leon Solent in Hampshire boasted the hottest day of the year so far yesterday, with the temperature rising to almost 27 degrees Celsius or 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Now for a look at today's papers, and the Sun leads with news that Britain's Got Talent runner-up Susan Boyle has been admitted to a London clinic suffering from exhaustion. The Mirror leads with a full-page photo of the winners of the talent show, a dance group called Diversity, who pipped Boyle to the prize. Today they go back to school, says the paper. Gordon Brown will resist any attempt to unseat him after Thursday's elections. That's according to the lead stories in The Times, The Mail and The Guardian. And The Independent splashes with news of the British Army's anger at the government's failure to supply more troops to Afghanistan. Shadow Chancellor George Osborne uses a column in the Financial Times to criticise the EU's response to the banking crisis. And on the back pages, The Express expects Carlo Ancelotti to be named the new Chelsea manager today. For the Mail, though, it's all change in Paris, as Rafael Nadal crashes out of the French Open, providing Britain's Andy Murray with a chance to win his first ever Grand Slam. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The wild tribal areas on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan have seen fierce fighting over the last few weeks between the Taliban and Pakistani forces. Pakistan now seems upbeat, with the Defence Secretary Syed Attar Ali declaring yesterday that the operation in the Swat Valley area should be over within a few days. Meanwhile, America seems to be using a very high-tech method to target Taliban and Al-Qaeda hideouts, microchips allegedly smuggled in by sympathetic tribesmen, which then guide missiles to the correct location. Our correspondent Declan Walsh in Islamabad tells us what evidence there is that these microchips really exist.
It comes from both the people who are coming out of Waziristan, where most of these American drone strikes have occurred, and from the Taliban propaganda themselves. The Taliban have issued videos featuring local young men making confessions, saying that they were paid by the unknown people, but presumably the Americans, to drop these mysterious electronic devices outside the homes of Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders, and that these homes were subsequently hit by American drones. So it's both on the basis of that and on the basis of local people who say that these microchips are the talk of the town in the tribal areas, because the Taliban have become so paranoid about flushing out the people who they suspect are planting them against them.
So tell us a little bit more about how they work.
Well, as we understand it, these microchips or electronic devices transmit some sort of signal that then allows the CIA and the US military to identify the homes of Taliban and particularly Al-Qaeda militants in the tribal areas. Those coordinates are then used by American drones, which are launched from a very remote desert base in Pakistan, but which in fact are piloted by personnel who are sitting in an Air Force base in Nevada in the US. These drones then appear overhead. They're armed with very sophisticated laser-guided weapons, and in some cases with 500-pound bombs, which are then used to target the Al-Qaeda figures.
And are the Taliban then completely defenseless against this kind of attack, basically?
There's certainly very little they can do once the drones appear overhead. And what they're trying to do is to stem the flow of information that will allow these drones to strike. I think in the early years of the American campaign, covert campaign in Waziristan, I think they were very reliant upon electronic surveillance to try and track down Osama bin Laden and his deputies. I think that in recent years, these foreign fighters, as they're known, have shunned all forms of electronic communication, knowing that it can be tracked, things like mobile phones, satellite phones, the internet, and so on. So they're living in these remote mountain villages, and the Americans have realized the only way to, one of the main ways to successfully track them is to use what they call human intelligence. So they are recruiting these Pakistani tribesmen, or indeed Pashtun tribesmen from across the border in Afghanistan, who are then tasked with locating specific individuals. What the Taliban are trying to do is they are monitoring cross-border traffic. And they have tried and executed dozens, probably over 100 local people, who they accuse of being part of this scheme.
And what have the Americans and the Pakistanis said about this tactic? And does the US have the support of the Pakistani government in doing this?
Well, in public, there's a bit of a charade that goes on around the whole issue of the drones. As far as the US is concerned, of course, it doesn't officially exist. This is, in name at least, a covert CIA operation, even though many administration officials do tend to nod towards the drones. In Pakistan, there is a lot of public resentment about the drones because they are seen as an infringement of sovereignty, and they provide a focus to already pre-existing and very vivid anti-American sentiment here. So every time there's a drone attack, Pakistani government officials go on the record condemning them. In reality, however, the Pakistan government is complicit in these drone attacks. They help the CIA. They provide them with the facilities they need to carry them out. There are CIA personnel stationed inside Pakistan military bases across the tribal belt. But there is a sense here in Pakistan that as the war against the Taliban becomes more intense, we've just seen 3 weeks of very heavy fighting in the Swat Valley, where the army claims to have pushed the Taliban back. Public opinion is shifting, and I've noticed in speaking to officials that people are much less afraid now of saying that they support these drone strikes because they are hitting a mutual enemy.
Indeed, the Pakistanis seem quite confident of late about their successes in the Swat Valley. They're back in control of the town of Mingora. What's next for this operation?
Next is to take the fight to the area where these drones are actually hitting, which is in south and north Waziristan. The army realizes that south Waziristan, particularly where the Taliban warlord Baitullah Massoud is located, is very much the heartland, the Taliban heartland in Pakistan. And if they are serious indeed about eradicating the Taliban problem in killing or capturing the leaders of the movement, then they realize they need to take the fight to Waziristan. Already there's been several fairly heavy clashes between the army and the militants, and that scene is very much a prelude to the operation that's probably coming over the next couple of weeks or perhaps months.
And that was Declan Walsh in Islamabad. And you can read more about that story on our website at guardian.co.uk/world. And elsewhere on the Guardian website today, a tale of land grabs, violence and destruction in the Amazon, as we bring you the results of a major investigation into the leather trade. Read that at guardian.co.uk/environment. As the festival season begins, we find out how Ibiza is fighting to attract clubbers back to its shores. That's at guardian.co.uk/music. And Charlie Brooker asks, why aren't women running the world yet? Have your say at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Another week, another round of revelations about MPs' expenses. They've become as everyday a feature as cornflakes and the postman. And yet public anger hasn't died down. This week, the performance of the main political parties on the expenses issue will be tested by European and, in some areas, local elections. It's widely expected the public will deliver an indignant blow to Labour and the other main parties by voting for the smaller ones. Just one of the worries Gordon Brown is facing just now. Our political correspondent, Allegra Stratton, sums up how the weekend went for the Prime Minister and what we can expect from him in the week ahead.
Not a very good weekend, especially as bearing in mind that on Thursday he's got big, big elections that a lot of people have been predicting are not going to be good. On Saturday morning we had a poll in the Times which shows that the doomsday scenario, which a lot of people have been predicting over the last few weeks, may indeed come to pass, and that is that Labour will come fourth behind the United Kingdom Independence Party. And then yesterday in the Sunday Telegraph we have Labour doing as badly as it did in 1987, which is a long time ago.
And how convincing do you think Gordon Brown's performance was on Andrew Marr's programme?
Well, for a man who's had a week's holiday, he looked pretty tired. Some of the ideas he was coming up with, to someone like me who has to sort of follow his every twist and turn, that they're not new ideas. The Star Chamber is something that's been around for a couple of weeks, and the idea that all that MPs' expenses will be raked over, that again has been around for about a month. So in reality, the political capital, does he have enough to be able to force that through? And when I was talking to his advisers and saying, well, is this again going to be something that will be a cross-party initiative, that where he'll bring in Clegg, he'll bring in Cameron, they didn't seem too keen on that. So the details of which have yet to be worked out, and in terms of sort of this new cross-party consensus spirit, I don't think it's with us on this one.
He also talked about a shake-up of all public institutions, including the NHS and the BBC. Do you think that's something that people really want, or do you think that's Gordon Brown failing to grasp the real issue of what people see as corruption in Westminster?
Pretty peculiar, absolutely right. I mean, it just sounded a bit beside the point. I mean, most people will have thought, sorry, what the benighted NHS done wrong? There are problems with the BBC that are raised continuously about, you know, for instance, Jonathan Ross on his £80 million salary. But as you say, there's a huge job on his hands for dealing with Westminster politics. And it was a bizarre political decision to bring in, you know, the NHS, the most beloved institution in the country, at BBC not far behind it.
So if Thursday's elections do go as badly as some of these polls are suggesting, what would you say the future holds for Gordon Brown?
Talking to some of the people who are involved in this now infamous steady drumbeat of planning to get rid of him as soon as there's bad elections on the morning after the local and European polls, they're very keen to be quiet at the moment. They don't want to be blamed for any bad result on Thursday, even though this probably would be for forces beyond their control. So they're not saying anything on the record when usually they will go on the record. And there is a fear in their camp that if Brown moves very quickly on the Friday morning, immediately after the polls, that their momentum will be lost because he'll have possibly persuaded people to come into a government. And we're talking about junior ministers. The government has got, you know, some hundreds involved in it. If he can manage to bring in junior ministers, he then buys into the sort of next phase of the government, people who might ordinarily be persuaded to sign some kind of letter calling on him to go. So they're aware that if he moves quickly, they may lose their hand, because it will become very difficult to persuade people to call on him to go when they've just said, I'll serve in your government.
So some kind of reshuffle, perhaps, at least?
Certainly there will be a reshuffle on Friday morning. It's a good way to bring energy into a very tired government. And, you know, people are talking about, you know, asking the question, what will be his Peter Mandelson moment? Because bringing Peter Mandelson back last October was a masterstroke. Will he send Ed Balls to the Treasury? And will he put Alistair Darling over at the Home Office? We just don't know. But even if he's able to, he has some problems in the lower orders of government with, for instance, Shahid Malik in trouble over his expenses. Don't know, but it's possibly something that he spent the last 10 days figuring out.
Allegra Stratton talking to me there. And there's a full guide to all this week's elections at guardian.co.uk/politics. The American car manufacturing giant General Motors is expected to file for bankruptcy today and is likely to shut down production while a judge decides the details of its future. This will be one of the largest bankruptcies in American history and one which will have an impact on the lives of thousands of workers and their families. They will no doubt be tuned into every news bulletin today to find out what the future holds, whether they still have jobs and salaries. Our US business correspondent Andrew Clarks outlines what they can expect.
What we're expecting today is that there'll be some kind of statement from President Obama who will tell the country why it's necessary for America's largest motor manufacturer to go into bankruptcy. And the company will essentially file what's called a Chapter 11 declaration, which seeks protection from its creditors. And the bankruptcy judge will then intervene to thrash out exactly what's going to happen to General Motors assets, how much the government will get, how much unions will get, and how much bondholders who are owed $27 billion will receive of the entire entity.
So does this then become a case of breaking up the company in order to keep parts of it viable?
Well, it's not exactly breaking up the assets. It's more breaking up ownership. Shareholders in GM on the stock market are likely to emerge with nothing. A lot of people have large claims on General Motors. The government has lent the company $19 billion. Bondholders have lent the company $27 billion. And the United Auto Workers Union is owed a great deal of money that General Motors is supposed to be putting into a fund providing healthcare for retired employees. So essentially what the judge will decide is, well, what is likely to happen is that instead of those obligations, these different parties will take ownership stakes in General Motors, and the judge will decide how much each one gets.
So what does this actually mean in practical terms for GM and its workers? What's the future for GM as a motor manufacturer?
We're looking at a much smaller, more streamlined General Motors. Companies already made it clear that a number of brands will shut, including Pontiac and Saturn. Other brands are up for sale, including Hummer, Saab, Opel and Vauxhall in Europe are being sold off. So what we're really looking at is a slimmed down, much more focused company. 2 years ago, General Motors had about 130,000 manufacturing employees in the United States. And they've said that by 2011, that will fall to about 38,000. So really, the sheer scale of the company is declining at a very rapid rate. And they're trying to find a level at which they can produce cars that make money, which they haven't been doing for quite some time.
Indeed. And GM's European arm looks likely to have been saved, at least for the time being, by last week's deal with Canadian car parts manufacturer Magna. What do you think this will mean for British jobs?
Well, I mean, there's a great deal of uncertainty over British jobs. There's about 5,000 people employed making Vauxhall vehicles in Luton and in Ellesmere Port on Merseyside. The German government has provided a great deal of money and bridge funding for Magna to buy these European operations. And there is a feeling that quid pro quo could be that German workers get protected at the expense of British ones. Peter Mandelson is lobbying aggressively and vigorously to try and make sure that's not the case, and to try and make sure that as many British jobs are saved as possible. But there is a feeling that those jobs in Luton could be particularly vulnerable.
Andrew Clark speaking to me from New York. Police in Britain appealed this weekend for business tycoon Ian Griffin to contact them urgently, several days after his girlfriend was found battered to death in an exclusive Paris hotel. Mr. Griffin is alleged to have driven away from the hotel in his Porsche and has since been seen in England. Our reporter Robert Booth has more on where Mr. Griffin is thought to have been since his girlfriend's murder.
Well, he was seen leaving the hotel in his black Porsche 911, and it's thought that originally that he was planning to travel to the south of France, where Kinga Legge, his girlfriend, had chartered a yacht. However, it seems that he travelled across the Channel, or through the Channel Tunnel, it's not entirely clear, back to the UK, because on Wednesday, the day afterwards, he turned up at a boatyard in Surrey, where he has a sports boat, a kind of a speedboat, if you like, often used for water skiing and so on, which he had already been asked to, he'd already commissioned some work on that to make it seaworthy. And he turned up and he wanted to know if that work could be brought forward very quickly. And he seemed agitated, according to the people at the boatyard, when he was told that that wasn't going to be possible, and went away having purchased a naval maritime GPS system and also some other naval charts which related to British and Irish waters and also European waters, which have led some police and some observers to think that maybe he, at that point, he was considering a kind of seaside getaway. Then his black Porsche was found up in Cheshire, near where he was brought up, near his parents' home, suggesting perhaps that he was then there. And yesterday, on Sunday, we learnt that the police in Cheshire had received numerous sightings of Mr. Griffin across the UK, but in particular in the northwest, and one in Manchester city centre. So it now seems that he may well be in Britain and may well be in that area.
And police have been calling for him to give himself up.
That's right. I think they feel that, first of all, that people know, his acquaintances and his family know where he is or have been in touch with him, perhaps. And they also feel that there's a danger that he may want to try and kill himself, and they are concerned about that.
Tell us a bit more about the background of this couple. They obviously lived quite a lavish lifestyle with these boats and smart cars and so on. What kind of business were they into, and what do people say about them as characters?
Well, they came from two very different backgrounds. Kinga Legg, she was now 36 when she died, and she came from a farming background in a place called Opatowek in Poland. She transformed the family farm really into a multinational business called Vegex, and she made a fortune by selling vegetables to multinational companies such as Tesco and McDonald's and Carrefour, the French supermarket chain. She then moved to the UK, hooked up with a council official in Preston who she married, that's Mr. Legg, and then went on to become part of the sort of wealthy Cheshire set after she became estranged from Mr. Legg, and subsequently met Ian Griffin. Now, Ian Griffin's story seems to be slightly different. He, if you look at Companies House, he's got a whole string of companies, many of which are now dissolved. So he seems to be something of a serial entrepreneur. And of course, there's various things that he's been involved with, one of which, of course, was the gadget shop. And he's been pictured in a rather sort of bizarre photograph, stood on top of a personalised hovercraft outside his gadget shop. Other businesses that he's been involved with are tanning shops and telecoms companies.
That was Robert Booth. You may think there are already plenty of UN agencies with acronyms made up of virtually every letter in the alphabet, but one more agency is expected to be added to the list, and some will say, not a moment too soon. The United Nations has never had an agency dealing specifically with women and issues such as HIV/AIDS and sex trafficking. Guardian reporter Mark Tran talked to Stephen Lewis, co-director of AIDS Free World, who hopes the UN will pass a resolution on the Women's Agency this year.
I actually sympathize with the question in people's minds about an additional UN agency, because some of them have performed inadequately. But the reason a recommendation came from a high-level panel on which the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom sat to have a UN agency for women is because of the lamentable neglect of women and women's issues over the years by the United Nations system, and the tremendous vulnerability of women around the world on every issue, from sexual trafficking to female genital mutilation to HIV and AIDS to poverty to conflict, and the need for a strong presence on the part of the United Nations to speak with and for women and to give them the resources that are required. It's been such an abject failure for so long that it's unconscionable not to have a presence for 52% of the world's population.
And how close are we to having such an agency?
I have never seen anything move more swiftly in the UN, which usually moves from inertia to paralysis, as the momentum around the creation of a women's agency, which may well happen this year. There is a request from the governments to the Secretary General that the architecture of the agency be designed and suggested, and that it be passed into law, as it were, by the end of this session, which means before the middle of September 2019.
So where do you see this agency having a practical effect? What are the areas that you see that it needs to get its hands on?
I would think that maternal mortality, the tremendous levels of more than 500,000 women dying in childbirth every year unnecessarily, the carnage that wrecks, can be addressed by the agency. I saw for all the years I was the UN's envoy on HIV/AIDS in Africa how disproportionately infected were the women and how the need for a voice to defend and protect the women was needed and was absent. The situation of sexual violence in conflict is a horrendous nightmare for women around which the nations of the world are not yet galvanized because there hasn't been leadership on the issue. The whole question of poverty, living on less than $1 a day, tens of millions of women in so many developing countries. The need for a constant voice that is uncompromising and principled and drives the issues home, this is what the UN Women's Agency will do, just as, may I say, UNICEF does for children.
What kind of resources are we talking about for this agency compared to resources that are available now?
What is available for all the fragments which purport to represent women's needs now is roughly in the vicinity of $200 million. What we're hoping to pull together is $1 billion. Will that require more money from governments like that of the United Kingdom? Absolutely. Is it legitimate? Without question, because women have been so long neglected by the UN. Is it okay in respect of other agencies? Yes. It's one-third of what UNICEF receives, $3 billion. One quarter of what the United Nations Development Program receives, $4 billion. The same for the World Food Program. This would still fund the Women's Agency at levels lower than we would wish, but levels which are acceptable at the outset.
Mark Tran talking to Stephen Lewis there. And that's it from Monday's edition of Guardian Daily. Today's producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thank you for listening.